This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we take a look at two very important First Amendment cases in the United States Supreme Court, NRA versus Vulo and Murthy versus Missouri. ACLU National Legal Director David Cole, who actually argued the NRA case before the United States Supreme Court, joins us to dig deeper into those cases and explain the implications for the First Amendment.
We'll also speak with two of the three authors of the new book, Abolition Labor, The Fight to End Prison Slavery.
We speak with Professor Andrew Ross and also a former incarcerated person, Ayuba Thomas, on this terrific book, The 13th Amendment, Abolish Slavery, but Not in Prison.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties. When does the government cross the line from using its highly visible bully pulpit to advocate for policies and principles it has every right to promote into the prohibited zone of threatening to use its awesome powers to punish viewpoints it opposes by coercing others to refrain from doing business with the speaker? In two very important recent decisions, the United States Supreme Court was asked to decide whether it is still the law of the land that a government entity's threat of invoking legal sanctions and other means of coercion against a third party to achieve the suppression of disfavored speech violates the First Amendment. In National Rifle Association versus Vulo, in a rare unanimous opinion written by Justice Sonia Sotomayor, the court held that, quote, government officials cannot attempt to coerce private parties in order to punish or suppress views that the government disfavors, unquote. But the decision in the related case of Murthy versus Missouri was not unanimous. In that case, earlier, a federal district judge had ruled that the U.S. Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy, and other government officials in the Biden administration violated the First Amendment by seeking to convince social media platforms to remove content the government deemed disinformation about COVID, the 2020 election, and other projects. But on June 26th, the court punted. A six-member majority, made up of both conservatives and liberals, held that the plaintiffs did not have standing to bring the suit in the first place. In dissent, three conservative justices said they would have found standing, and on the merits, they would have found a First Amendment violation. To discuss these important rulings, we've invited the lawyer who argued the NRA case in the Supreme Court. David Cole has been the National Legal Director of the American Civil Liberties Union since 2016. He previously served as a staff attorney for the Center for Constitutional Rights. He has litigated a wide array of major civil liberties controversies and has personally argued eight cases before the U.S. Supreme Court and served as counsel in more than 30. David, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me. If I'm not mistaken, one of my very first mentors was one of the early hosts of Law and Disorder, Michael Ratner, so I'm glad to be on.
That's so nice to hear. Michael and I went to law school together, and I have such wonderful memories of him.
Oh, well, we didn't go to law school together, but I worked for him at CCR. That was my first job. I lived in the basement of his house while I was a student working for him, and he managed to get me hired there. So I really attribute my career to Michael. He was an incredible leader and lawyer.
That is so nice to hear, and you've come so far from that basement. Just briefly tell us the facts. What was alleged in the NRA case?
So in the NRA case, the allegations, and most of it was based on public activity by government officials in New York, were essentially that the then-Governor Andrew Cuomo, and his chief financial regulator, a woman named Maria Vullo, agreed to go after the NRA, and particularly in the wake of the Parkland shooting and the sort of all the focus on gun control at that time, they didn't like the fact that the NRA was advocating for gun rights, not for gun control. And so they openly criticized the NRA, and, you know, Andrew Cuomo basically made the NRA his sort of his bete noir, his enemy publicly. But not satisfied simply to speak out against the NRA, they turned to use Maria Vullo's authority over financial institutions in New York to effectively coerce those entities into cutting their ties to the NRA, to blacklisting the NRA. Why? Because they disagreed with the NRA's political viewpoints. And so Vullo allegedly met with one of the NRA's principal insurance providers, Lloyd's of London, and said, look, Lloyd's, you know, we've looked into your records. You've got a bunch of infractions here, but we're willing to overlook them if you, or go easy on you with respect to them, if you will cut your ties to the NRA and help us in our campaign to weaken the NRA. And Lloyd's agreed, and shortly thereafter did indeed announce that it was cutting all ties to the NRA. Vullo then issued formal guidance letters using her regulatory authority over financial institutions in New York to issue these formal guidance letters that went to literally every bank and insurance company in the state that she oversees, urging them to reconsider their any business they do with the NRA, quote, and other gun promotion organizations, again, because they promote gun rights, not because they're engaged in any legal infractions, but because they promote views that the leaders of the Democratic Party in New York disagreed with. And 6 weeks later, she announced consent decrees that with several of the NRA's insurance providers, in which they paid millions of dollars of fines and agreed never to do business with the NRA ever again, even if that business was totally lawful to do so. And so the NRA then brought suit and said, this violates our First Amendment rights to single us out because of our views, and to urge companies that you directly oversee to cut their ties with us, to blacklist us, because you don't like what we say, violates the First Amendment right of organizations to advocate for things they believe in. And the district court in the case agreed and said, on these facts, that does state a violation of the First Amendment. But Vullo appealed, and the Second Circuit, Federal Court of Appeals in New York, unanimously reversed and said, no, this is not compulsion, this is not coercion, this is just government speech. These were just government officials expressing their points of view, and governments or officials are free to express their points of view. So it was at that point that the case went up to the U.S. Supreme Court.
And now we know that in a rare unanimous opinion by Justice Sotomayor, the Supreme Court reversed the Second Circuit and has allowed this case to proceed since it's only at the pleading stage. Tell us the analysis of the court. What were the key First Amendment principles and some of the previous case law that the court relied on?
Yeah. One of the things that the court emphasized was that it was not making new law in this case. Both the majority and the concurrence expressly said, we're simply applying settled law. So what is that settled law? That settled law comes from a case called Bantam Books versus Sullivan back 60 years ago, which involved a situation in which a Rhode Island commission was created, had no direct authority to punish anybody, but their job was to be concerned with the morals and values of young people. And one of the things that they focused on was access by young people to indecent and obscene literature. And so they made lists of books that they thought were improper for young people to have access to. And they then wrote letters to bookstores and said, hey, you know, we've identified these books. We think they're, you know, inappropriate for kids to see, and so we urge you not to sell these books. And a police officer would follow up and sort of, you know, ask, you know, what, did you get that letter? You know, what's going on here? They said, well, we have the authority to refer matters for prosecution, but they had not actually prosecuted anyone. They had not referred any matter, so it was not formal censorship, but it was informal censorship, and it wasn't directed at the books themselves. It was directed at third parties, the booksellers, to try to get them to not sell the books. And what the court said was, in that case, was you can't do indirectly. The government can't do indirectly what it couldn't do directly. The fact that it is targeting booksellers doesn't allow it to penalize books because it doesn't like what they say, because it finds them indecent, because it finds them inappropriate for kids, etc. And that's been the law. And in essence, what the Supreme Court said in NRA versus Vullo is that Maria Vullo did just what the Rhode Island Commission did in Bantam Books. She used the coercive and regulatory authority that she had to encourage / coerce third parties, the banks and insurance companies, to punish a speaker because she doesn't like what that speaker said. And when government agencies do that, when they coerce private parties to penalize others because of their protected speech, that violates the First Amendment. And so that is the law. It's been the law. It was, clearly triggered by what these New York State officials did here. But the hard thing in these cases is, how do you draw the line between persuasion, which is permissible, and coercion, which is not? Because government officials, there's nothing wrong with Governor Cuomo holding a press conference and saying, I think the NRA is a terrible organization, and I think people should not support the NRA. He has the right to say that. Government officials can express their views, and they can say those sorts of things. What they can't do is coerce others into penalizing or censoring speech because the government doesn't like that speech. And so it's really that, how do you draw the line between persuasion and coercion? The court held here, it's clearly coercive when you say to somebody, as Vullo did to Lloyd's of London, if you don't do what we want and cut ties to the NRA, we're going to come after you full bore. If you do what we want, we'll go easy on you, right? That's you're employing your regulatory authority over that individual to add, a lot of persuasive force to what you're asking them to do. And the same thing with her guidance letters. These were not, just an op-ed that she published in the New York Times. This was an official document. It is goes to every bank and every insurance company. They are obligated to, follow the guidance letters. If they don't follow the guidance letters, they can be subject to substantial fines. And then shortly thereafter, she did impose $1 million fines on a couple of the insurance companies. So, that's an instance in which you see real government coercion backing the government speech, and in NRA versus Vullo, the court says that that violates the First Amendment.
It was a unanimous opinion. All of the justices fully joined in that result. But as you indicate, there were concurring opinions, and there was one particularly forceful one from Justice Jackson. What are those concurring judges getting at? Is there any crack in the First Amendment wall against coercion? And what can we learn from the concurring opinions?
You know, I actually don't think all that much. I think that they all agree that what was alleged here violates the First Amendment. They all agree that government officials are free to express their points of view. They're not free to wield the force of their office to put a exclamation point at the end of their sentence. They're not free to, you sort of imply that their coercive authority, do this or else. I don't think the concurrences will, in the long run, make much difference. Justice Jackson, was basically saying, well, in Bantam Books, the actual action that the commission was seeking from the third party, the bookseller, was to suppress the speech. In this instance, the actual action that the government officials were seeking from the banks and insurance companies was not the suppression of speech, but cutting off business, penalizing the entity economically. And she said in that instance, in Bantam Books, it's obviously a speech motivated because it's targeting speech and trying to suppress books. Where the government is not directly seeking or not seeking to have a third party censor speech, but simply seeking to have a third party take adverse action, not speech related action, just adverse action against somebody, you have to also demonstrate that the reason they're urging the third party to take adverse action against the NRA is because the government disapproves of the NRA's speech. So she was just underscoring you got to have that showing, but in this case they, Vullo and Cuomo made that absolutely clear. I mean, when Maria Vullo issued the guidance letters, they are titled, the risks of, guidance regarding risks of doing business with the NRA and other gun promotion organizations. She was specifically focused on the fact that they promote guns and gun rights, not on their, engaging in any kind of illegal activity. And promoting guns and gun rights, not something I generally support, but it's protected under the First Amendment. And Cuomo issued a press release on the day that the guidance letters went out in which he said, we're urging you to cut your ties with the NRA because doing business with the NRA, quote, sends the wrong message, unquote. So it was, in our case, it was clear that the motivation for targeting the NRA was not that it engaged in, any kind of illegal activity, but simply that it engaged in advocacy that the government officials disagreed with. And I think, many of your listeners are likely on the left and are probably not super supportive of the NRA. But I think, you can imagine the same situation in a state like Texas, in which, the governor and his top financial regulator urges a blacklist of immigrants' rights groups, or Florida, Governor DeSantis urging a blacklist of LGBT rights groups or trans rights groups or Planned Parenthood. And I think, most people would agree that if you're targeting a group, a trans rights group or an immigrants rights group or an abortion rights group, because of what it advocates, that triggers the First Amendment. And the same thing is true with advocacy of gun rights.
Well, that plays into my next question. The ACLU got some flack from some of its affiliates and others questioning why would the ACLU be representing the NRA? So why would the ACLU spend its time, its resources, your powerful legal arguments defending the NRA?
So I think it's this is sort of in the ACLU's DNA. We are probably best known for the fact that we represented the Nazis who wanted to march in Skokie in the 1970s. We have long been an organization that is committed to defending constitutional rights for all, not for just the people with whom we agree, not for just the people we like, but for all. And we think that is critically important to the legitimacy of the rights. If rights are only going to be enforced for people you agree with, then why would anyone who disagrees with you support those rights? The rights have to be sort of universally applied. And so, you know, we've long done this work. I mean, we've, you know, in my time at the ACLU, we have filed briefs in support of Donald Trump's rights. We challenged the scope of a gag order that the federal court imposed on Donald Trump in connection with the January 6th case. We've filed a lawsuit on behalf of Milo Yiannopoulos, an anti-trans activist and provocateur whose advertisement for his book was the subway system in Washington refused to put it up because they thought it was too controversial. We've represented fundamentalist Christian groups that, you know, with whom we disagree on lots of Establishment Clause kinds of concerns, but where their First Amendment rights were violated by the city of Boston. We've represented white supremacists. We've represented anti-Semitic speakers, and I think it's really important to the legitimacy of our of this organization, to the credibility of the organization, to do that work. I think it's critically important to the sort of value of the First Amendment that it does, in fact, protect both those, you know, with whose views we agree and those, you know, with whose views we disagree. We disagree, you know, largely with the NRA's views on gun rights, but we believe they have a right to speak out just as we do, and that if we don't protect them, then we're not going to be in a very good position to protect others that would get targeted with the same, you know, sorts of tactics. The ACLU is a large organization, you know, well over 2,000 people across the country in the ACLU and its affiliates, and so understandably, there's going to be disagreements within the ACLU about particular controversial cases, and so there was some disagreement. The NYCLU issued a public statement; they didn't think we should be representing the NRA in this case. We thought it was an important case to do, the important principle at stake. The NRA had lost unanimously in the Second Circuit. We thought it sent a very strong message to the Supreme Court that we, the ACLU, were willing to stand up and defend the NRA, because the court knows the ACLU doesn't agree with the NRA, but the fact that we nonetheless were willing to stand up and defend it underscores how important the First Amendment principles at stake were. And, you know, I think, you know, no one will know ever know, but may well have helped in generating a unanimous decision upholding those First Amendment principles.
Thank you for making that so clear, David. You mentioned 2,000. You meant the staff of the two. You have millions of ACLU supporters.
Oh, millions, right? Of millions and millions of members. But I'm just talking about the full-time, you know, the full-time staff of the national office has about 600 people, and the affiliates have between them, you know, well over 1,500 people across the country. So it's a large organization, and not everybody agrees with everything that certainly not everyone agrees with everything the NRA does, but not everyone agrees with everything the ACLU does. So it's not all that surprising that there's disagreement, but, you know, we were clear that it was the right thing to do. We went through a process. We made sure everybody's views were heard, but we ultimately decided to go forward. And I think, you know, the result, vindicates our decision.
So let's turn to the second case, the Murthy case. Just briefly explain the facts in that case and how this 6-3 decision came out.
So, yeah, Murthy versus Missouri is a lawsuit filed by two states, Missouri and I believe Louisiana, and a number of individuals against a wide range of federal government officials. Murthy is Vivek Murthy, the Surgeon General, but they included, you know, members of the CDC, the FBI, the White House, et cetera. And the claim was the government officials during the pandemic were reaching out to social media platforms, especially Facebook and Twitter, and urging them to take down what the government officials considered to be disinformation or misinformation about COVID, about vaccines, and the like. And so they would see some false information about the dangers of vaccines being posted on Facebook or Twitter, and would call Facebook and Twitter and say, "Hey, this is false. It's causing people to not get vaccinated, which is causing people to die, and we think you should take it down." And indeed, Twitter and Facebook did take down a fair amount of misinformation and disinformation about COVID during the pandemic. And so the claim was, as it was in the NRA versus Vulo case, that the government was targeting third parties, in this case social media platforms, and urging them to suppress speech that the government didn't like. And so the case raised very similar questions to NRA versus Vulo. Were the government officials simply persuading Facebook and Twitter to take stuff down, or were they coercing Facebook and Twitter to take the stuff down? And the court ultimately decided not to decide the question. They held 6-3 that there was no standing to bring this challenge because the people who brought the challenges were unable to prove that the reason Twitter and Facebook took this stuff down was because of these entreaties by federal government officials. And more importantly, they were unable to show that they faced a risk that this would happen to them again in the future, because they were seeking an injunction against future actions by government officials, not damages for past actions. And, you know, the pandemic is largely over. There's not a lot of, this kind of activity going on anymore. And so they said, there's not a concrete dispute here. And therefore, we don't need to reach the question. Three justices dissented. They said there was sufficient connection here and that the government did, in fact, violate the First Amendment by going beyond mere persuasion to coercion. That was the dissent was written by Alito and joined by Thomas and Gorsuch.
And this was at a preliminary injunction stage, so this case could go back for a trial?
Well, it could, although I don't think they're going to be able to demonstrate standing for the reasons that the majority set out. I mean, you know, first of all, the stuff is not going on at this point, and so what's the necessity of forward-looking relief? And secondly, this was a mess of a case. I mean, it was really hard to demonstrate any sort of direct causal relationship between what Twitter and Facebook did and what these government officials did. Twitter and Facebook was taking down misinformation about COVID and vaccines before government officials got involved and reached out to them at all. They had their own policies that prohibited this stuff. And so in many instances, it was just the government was calling and saying, "Hey, you know, you missed this post that violates your own policy." And, you know, anyone can call Twitter and Facebook and say that. And it's up to Twitter and Facebook to determine whether the information violates their policies and to take it down or not take it down. And Twitter and Facebook often did not follow what the government officials said. And then lastly, the government officials did not have direct authority to prosecute Twitter or Facebook. I mean, CDC calls Facebook and says, you know, "We think you've got something up there that's not good and shouldn't be up there." And Facebook says, "Well, that's great. Thank you. Bye-bye." There's nothing CDC can do to Facebook. They have no regulatory authority over Facebook. That's not true with Maria Vulo and the banks and financial institutions that she was, threatening with enforcement, direct enforcement of financial institution regulations against them if they didn't do her bidding. So I think there's a big difference between the two cases. And had they reached the merits, my suspicion is that the plaintiffs would have lost. A lot of questions at the oral argument from people like Justice Kagan and Justice Kavanaugh, both of whom worked in the White House, about, well, you know, doesn't this happen every day? Don't government officials call the New York Times and say, "Hey, you know, this story you're planning on running, it's wrong, it's false. You shouldn't run it. You know, this op-ed is a terrible idea. don't run it. And New York Times hears them out, and it makes its own decision. And that's not considered a violation of the First Amendment. It's considered government speech. So I think, you know, this was a mess of a case. They really didn't tie what the government did to any coercion on the private entities that would lead to the private entities taking action. And absent that, the majority said you don't even have standing to sue, much less a right to an injunction.
David, thank you so much. You bring so much clarity to these issues. You help us understand these issues. And even more than that, thank you for the vital work you do in protecting civil liberties every day.
Well, thank you. You know, shows like this, which educate the public about the importance of civil rights and civil liberties, are all part of the fabric of protecting civil rights and civil liberties and making them a real in this country and not just words on a page.
And of course, we can always reach the ACLU at aclu.org.
Absolutely.
Great. Thank you very much, and thank you for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. Operating in the secrecy of the nation's more than 1,800 prisons, for decades, a kind of shadow slave culture has been fostered. Few Americans are aware of the exploitative and pervasive practice of forced prison labor. The 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution abolished slavery, but it made one exception: prison labor. Prisoners are forced to work with minimal or non-existent wages and often with no labor protections. Understanding the scope and implications of forced prison labor is crucial for anyone concerned with social justice and equality. It calls for a re-examination of our treatment of incarcerated persons and for alternatives that promote fairness for everyone, regardless of their legal status. By shining a light on this issue, we can advocate for reforms that prioritize rehabilitation over punishment and strive toward a more just and humane criminal justice system. A new book, Abolition Labor: The Fight to End Prison Slavery, provides an eye-opening overview of the extent of this problem. Today, we're honored to talk with two of its three authors. Up first is Andrew Ross, a renowned social activist, author, and professor of social and cultural analysis at New York University, where he also directs the Prison Research Lab. Andrew has contributed to prominent publications like The Guardian, The New York Times, and The Nation. He has authored or edited over 25 books, with the recent work of Abolition Labor co-authored with Ayuba Thomas and Tommaso Bardelli. Andrew, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me back on.
Tell us how you first became interested in the issue of prison labor.
Well, one of my jobs is to direct the Prison Research Lab at New York University, and we and our formerly incarcerated students there, you know, do interviews with their peers, formerly incarcerated people. Prison labor is, I mean, it's impossible to avoid in the interviews that we do, but we decided to do this larger project and the book that came out of it, largely because prison labor is not well understood in the public mind. You know, when the topic comes up, most people think of license plates, or they think of Victoria's Secret or other corporations using prison labor. But in fact, the percentage of private contract labor for corporations is very small in this country. There are other misconceptions that I can talk about, but in general, we wanted to provide a more holistic picture of what it's like to labor behind the walls.
In a nutshell, please describe how prison labor works for people who don't know much about it.
Well, the first thing to be said is that it's a form of forced labor. A lot of our book is about the fight to end slavery, prison slavery, because forced labor is constitutionally authorized under the 13th Amendment. There's an exception clause in there that allows indentured servitude to exist for those who are convicted of a crime. And so we're talking about labor that's not free labor. And incarcerated men and women have no choice. And the jobs that they do pretty much cover the entire spectrum. Everything that, people do in the free world for a livelihood or a job, it also happens behind the walls. Everything from, you know, cleaning, basic cleaning of cells to skilled manufacturing and skilled service provision.
Speaking of the 13th Amendment's prison slavery exception, can you briefly discuss efforts to abolish it, and what other changes do you think need to be made to resolve this corrupt state?
Well, most Americans, it turns out, according to surveys, are unaware of the loophole in the 13th Amendment that authorizes forced labor behind bars. And a large part of our book is an effort to chronicle the movement to end the exception in the 13th Amendment. That is a national movement that has been proceeding in state after state, passing state constitutional amendments. Most recently, the California legislature actually just last week passed a bill to send an amendment to the ballot in November that voters will have a chance to vote on, and that was a big win. And there are seven other states that have passed those so far, and there's also a federal constitutional amendment campaign underway. So this is part of a movement. We're part of it in New York State. We're part of the coalition here trying to pass legislation in New York State. For the most part, it's an anti-slavery campaign, but there are also other consequences. Once you've abolished forced labor, then what do you do about the wages question? And this is a big issue within the movement. Do you push for legislation that will raise wages? Should it be a minimum wage? Should it be less than a minimum wage? Should other elements of the standard labor package, like the right to organize and workplace protection, should they be part of the package? These are all things that we discuss in the book, and we have our own positions, but we try to give an airing to others. So that's a large part of the book.
How does prison labor affect the broader economy and the economic lives of millions of American households?
That's a very good question, because during the era of mass incarceration, when we had more than 2 million American men and women locked up behind bars, basically we were withdrawing 2 million workers from the labor force. I mean, many of these people would not have been employed, and one of the favorite theories of mass incarceration at the time was that this was a form of warehousing surplus members of the working class who had been disemployed by deindustrialization, and they were just put behind bars where they were put to work running the prisons, basically. There's been a decline in incarcerated population since then. We're currently at about 1.2 million. We found in our interviews that there's a lot of continuity between what happens behind the walls and what happens in the free world economy. For example, most people in a low-wage economy, which is basically for most Americans what we live in, they need to have something on the side to supplement their income, right? This is the case also in prison. Because of the ultra-low wages, which, you know, average, let's say, in New York State, about 15 cents an hour. In some states, you're not paid at all. In order to survive, you have to have a hustle on the side. So there's a very vibrant informal economy, and we spend a lot of time in the book gathering testimony about it. So the more accurate picture of labor behind the walls is a lousy wage and a hustle. You have to have something to supplement the ultra-low pay that is available. And we find that that's not all that different from, as I said, the free world economy. And it's one of the reasons why so many people end up in prison, because they have to resort to illegal activities to get by, and why so many are reincarcerated, because they're not given a chance of adequate employment on reentry, so they revert to illegal activities and end up back inside.
This is Michael Smith. I'm with my co-host, Heidi Boghossian. We're speaking with Professor Andrew Ross, who's just had published the book Abolition Labor. Andrew, why is there such strong resistance to ending forced labor within the prison system?
There's a lot of resistance to it for a number of reasons. One of them is that if you give prisoners the right to refuse labor, then you take away a major component of discipline in the prison. You're taking away from prison guards a way of coercing and disciplining the population. Because if you refuse to work, then the consequences can be quite dire. You can end up in solitary confinement. You can have your privileges, all sorts of privileges cut off, and so on and so forth. So it alters the balance of power inside the prison. If you give incarcerated people the right to refuse certain kinds of work, either because they're ill-paid or they're unsafe or whatever. That's something we found, because the threat of violence is omnipresent in prisons. We found that balance of power is very important to maintain. The other reason is that if you withdraw forced labor, then, as I said earlier, there are these consequences that follow on, which lead to lawmakers asking themselves, well, how much will it cost the state if we have to raise wages? Forced labor is no longer legal, and their demands for higher wages, how much will it cost us?
Andrew, throughout the research and writing process with your two co-authors, what was your most surprising or impactful finding?
The most surprising, I think the most, well, first of all, we did interviews in four states, New York, Alabama, Georgia, and Texas. The three others, Texas and Georgia and Alabama, are places where people are not paid at all for their labor. I think Alabama was the most surprising. We spent quite a bit of time doing field trips to Alabama, and we were prepared for essentially a different kind of prison system. And given the history of Alabama, this resistance to, you know, racial reforms and convict leasing in Alabama was worse than in any other southern state during its heyday, lasted longer and was more brutal. So we were expecting something quite different from what we were used to in New York. But I don't think we expected to find such a completely lawless environment in the Alabama penitentiary system. There are very few guards, correctional officers, who are willing to take on that job, which is quite dangerous, only do it because they can earn a lot of money smuggling in contraband, drugs or guns or cell phones. And many of them are connected to organized crime on the outside. But there are basically not enough of them, really, to protect the incarcerated population. So it's a very lawless environment. There's a lot of violence. There's very little prospect of parole. You have more chance of coming out in a body bag than coming out on parole. The number of deaths every year is so skyrocketing. It's really difficult to summarize how awful it is, really. That was our biggest surprise, I think, even though we were expecting the worst in Alabama.
Andrew Ross, you've co-written the book Abolition Labor, and I wanted to ask you, what can the general public do to help end prison labor and address broader criminal justice reform issues?
One thing to do is educate yourself. Public education is very important. As I mentioned earlier on, there are a lot of misconceptions about prison labor. Another one I could mention is the extent of privatized prisons. In the public mind, a lot of prisons are under private operation, when in fact, probably less than 6% of the beds nationally are in private hands, and they're mostly concentrated in southern states. The vast majority of prison labor is done at the behest of public authorities, government agencies. Most of the manufactured goods and services are purchased by government agencies, and corporations play a limited role in all of this. So we think it's important that the public, members of the public who are interested, learn about this. One of the reasons we wrote the book, if you want to get involved in the campaigns, it's easy to do. Most states have a coalition that is trying to pass legislation. The one that we're involved in New York is called 13th Forward. It's a very broad coalition. There's a couple of bills that we push every year in the legislature. One is the Abolish Slavery Constitutional Amendment Bill. And the other one, and this is, we're the only state where this is currently the case. The other one is a wages bill called the Fairness and Opportunity for Incarcerated Workers. And that's a bill that would provide a minimum wage, right to organize, workplace protections, and also set up a statewide monitoring board for overseeing the implementation of those measures.
Andrew, how can our listeners follow your work?
We're part of NYU's Prison Education Program. We're the research arm of the Prison Education Program. That's the best place to follow what we do, and also our other publications, which include our last book, Cars and Jails, which we were also talking about on this show some time ago, a couple of years ago, I think. And so we're pretty active in pushing out our research into the public realm.
I wanted to mention, Andrew, that OAR Books published Cars and Jails and also published Abolition Labor, OAR Books. I think you can get it at oarbooks.com.
Thank you for your important work and for bringing these problems to the public fore. We're going to go speak with one of your co-authors, and we wish you the best with this wonderful book.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been a great pleasure to talk to you both.
Following Andrew, we're delighted to introduce another co-author of Abolition Labor, Ayuba Thomas. Ayuba recently earned his MA from NYU's Gallatin School of Individualized Study and is an affiliate of the NYU Prison Research Lab. He currently serves as project manager for the Movements Against Mass Incarceration's Archival Oral History Project at Columbia University. There, he documents the experiences and challenges faced by those affected by the criminal justice system. His first-hand perspective and his extensive knowledge on the subject makes him a powerful voice in the conversation of abolishing forced prison labor. Ayuba, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
How has your personal experience influenced your work on this book and also in the abolitionist movement?
As a person with lived experience, I actually had to go through a lot of the things that these other people we interviewed for this book went through. I didn't really see it to the same point of being such a big problem. It was just a personal thing of, I don't want to work here. I'm not getting paid. You know, this is terrible. I didn't really see the whole picture. But doing the research actually let me hone in and see the issues that are pervasively just attacking our system and attacking our communities.
Ayuba Thomas, you've worked as project manager for the Movement Against Mass Incarceration Project at Columbia University's Insight. How did that work influence the themes in Abolition Labor, the book that you co-authored?
Ironically enough, two of the organizations that I work with in the Movement Against Mass Incarceration are actually people I met through doing this research. So I work with an organization called Both Sides of the Wall. They were very integral in doing prison strikes on the inside as well as doing supportive protests on the outside, you know, going to the government stairs and approaching all of the the lawyers and the politicians to try to get this change to the system of Alabama's prison system, which is terrible. And then also Georgia, there's Bard Business, who is a company, that a nonprofit company that helps people in Georgia work, get work, and they have a lot of political movements, and they've been working on legislation to actually get the people who are formerly incarcerated protected class. So, you know, the work that I did with the incarceration, with the abolition labor, it actually influenced more of my work that I do right now currently.
Ayuba, what are the initial steps needed to fix this broken system of prison labor?
Well, there's a lot of steps, but it would help first by eradicating that clause in the 13th Amendment that allows people to be used as slave labor in the prison system. Something that happens frequently is that, you know, people get taken off of the streets and put into prison, removed from communities, removed from their families, and the work that they do, they don't get paid for. So what happens is the family has to then pull together and take more resources away from the community and make sure that person is sustained and has a healthy diet and is able to come home safely. So one of the biggest things right now is to be politicians and, you know, the community to forge together and try to get that exemption clause removed.
How do forced labor practices affect the families and communities of incarcerated individuals?
Prison is a duly extractive process, right? So a person who once was a provider or some kind of stationary placeholder in a family, whether it be financially, spiritually, or just a physical presence, that's removed. And then the community who's already missing a piece, who's already missing an addition, has to then take out of the losses that they have and contribute back into the prison system by sending their families money. The phone systems cost money, clothing costs money, food costs money. So the nature of prison is just to keep taking from the community. And it's a terrible thing.
Ayuba, what are the systemic and also cultural issues in America's penal system that perpetuate this forced labor and exploitation of incarcerated persons?
The system, you know, in itself is made to perpetuate and keep going and keep helping itself live. So as people are taken away from the communities, it's particular people that are taken away from the communities. A lot of people will contest that, you know, largely it's white people that are incarcerated, but it's only because of the disparity in how many people exist here. You know, the population of Black Americans that get locked up opposed to the populations of white Americans that get locked up, you know, statistically, it's pretty much like 5-1, 7-1 in a Black community, where it's 1-1. So that kind of says a lot. And when you think about the arrested development of the communities that these people are extracted from, they're already in marginalized and disenfranchised situations. So the system just keeps perpetuating itself, and it keeps people lingering in the same system, in the same locations, in the same ghettos. And as with the labor situation, if people don't have enough to sustain inside, they probably are going to go to doing illegal practices again. And then on top of that, when they're released, if they don't have enough to sustain outside, they're going to go to illegal practices again. So that's why we have such a large rate of recidivism. If people were to get paid, we're not asking for a whole lot of money, you know, just a little bit more, something when they're in prison, they can sustain. And then when they come home, that they're able to, you know, have a footing and have some kind of foundation so they don't get caught back up in the system.
We're speaking with Ayuba Thomas, a former incarcerated person. I wanted to ask you, Ayuba, how does the issue of prison labor intersect with other social justice issues, such as racist inequality and economic disparity, human rights?
I mean, it's a simple thing that when you lock people up and you take people away, they can't contribute no more. It happens in specific locales. It happens to specific communities, to specific populations. So it is racial inequality all through. I always say that we remember that a lot of this took place during with the emancipation era, you know, when people were freed and then became Jim Crow era, because the free people were being subjected to unfair laws, unfair behavior by the police officials, by the government officials, and we were extracted and taken off of the streets because we were, at the time, they called it vagrancy. So they have a bunch of different laws in different communities that are only there in those communities, and it doesn't exist outside of the place. Like, for example, I'll use bike riding, for example. There's been in the early 70s and the early 80s, they made in certain communities riding a bike on the street illegal. So that was a way for people to get drawn into the system. You know, you make these petty laws, you make these petty rules that people can't really abide by because it's not fair. If I don't have a job, where do you want me to be? It's unfair. And it's not, you know, directed at a general population. It's directed at specific populations.
Ayuba Thomas, thank you so much for being on Law & Disorder. Before we have to let you go, can you tell us how listeners can follow your work?
You know, I'm terrible at social media, but I do have a page at Insight. That's where I work with the movements for mass incarceration. We post up things there regularly. I'm also part of the NYU PP Research Lab, so you can look that up. But right now, you just Google my name. You know, I've done some work, and I'm going to continue to do work. Hopefully, you know, you can get to it and see it.
That's A-I-Y-U-B-A, Ayuba Thomas. Thank you so much, Ayuba. It's been really great having you on Law & Disorder. You take it easy.
Thank you for having me, and I really appreciate it. And, you know, you guys are doing great work, and continue the great work.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.